broadcasting in HD radio at 88.9 FM. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, and KBDH San Ardo, streaming live and podcasting at KUSP.org. Hey everybody, I'm Gary Shapiro, and it's time for From the Bookshelf.
Gary David Goldberg joins us tonight. He was the television writer and producer who created Family Ties and Spin City, and has now written a memoir called Sit, Ubu, Sit. Gary David Goldberg, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary. Great to be with you.
I have to tell you, when I was a kid, I had a pal in Rosewood Elementary School who was really funny. He cracked me up every day, and his name was Matt, and his dad was a comedy writer who became an important mentor to you, Nate Monister.
Wow, yeah, Nate Monister was the guy who changed my life. I mean, Nate Monister was the guy who turned my life around, who was the first human being to say, you know, maybe you could make a living as a writer. So, and Matt Monister, very funny guy,
In
L.A., we had a book party there at Dutton's Books, and I invited Matt, and he came, and I invited his mom, Gladys, and she came as well, so it was really a treat for me.
I haven't seen Matt since the seventh grade, but he was a funny, funny kid.
He looks the same.
And your daughter, Shana, she wrote and produced many episodes of the very funny show, Friends.
Yeah, Shana ended up being the executive producer and head writer of Friends, along with her husband, Scott Silveri, who was the other head writer and executive producer.
So do you think comedy is hereditary?
It seems to be in this limited sample that you've discussed, the Monister, Goldberg, Meehan family, yeah.
Well, what about your dad? Was he a funny guy?
No, my dad was he was just working. He was worked in the post office. He worked two jobs, sometimes three jobs. No, I wouldn't say he was a funny guy. He was a sweet and wonderful guy. My mother was caustically funny, very, very smart woman. And I was not funny as a kid. I don't think anyone who knew me the way you knew Matt would say, well, Gary was really funny. So it was an odd life choice, as it turned out.
Well, when you were a kid, I know you were obsessed with baseball, but were there comedians that you loved, and did you like comedy?
I didn't write comedy. Yes, there were, we had one of Phil Silvers, the Colgate Comedy Hour, then Sid Caesar's Show of Shows, Life of Riley with William Bendix, but it was so far from me being able to conceive of a thought that would connect me to that world. You know, it was so far outside of anything that was in our ability to even dream about. You know, it just seemed like that happened somewhere on Mars, and you couldn't ever find a way into that world.
Well, there's a certain rhythm. Now, you mentioned music a few times in your book, and you do a great impression of Miles Davis. If it's possible to do an impression in a book, you do that.
one not nice guy, relatively genius, but not a very nice man, at least to waiters at the Village Gate in the 60s.
And I want to talk about that a little bit, but let me ask you about comedy. There's a certain rhythm. And I think you're into music, so I don't know if those things are connected. But that rhythm is present in Family Ties, and that rhythm is present in Spin City and in your book.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, comedy is rhythm, and a lot of comedy writers, not me, are also very good musicians. On our show, Michael Whitehorn and Mark Lawrence, really good musicians. Mike Fox is a terrific musician. So that's not uncommon. There is a rhythm to it. There's a way to make it funny. There's a way to make it not funny. Same words delivered by different people. You laugh or you don't laugh. When you get to those old-time comics, guys like Rodney Dangerfield, you're laughing on sound. You don't even know what you're laughing at. They can make you laugh at will. And Mike Fox, when he was on a roll, Jack Benny, they tell you, you can laugh now. Now you laugh, and you can't help yourself.
Well, having mastered that rhythm, were you ever tempted to do stand-up, or was your Under the Yum Yum Tree acting experience?
Having been one of the worst actors ever, no, that's more attention than I like, and I'm not sure that I'm a great stand-up. Although going around the country reading portions of the book, I can make the audience laugh, and I know when they're going to laugh, But I don't. What's been not difficult and exciting at the same time for me has been going around with the book. getting all this emotion and all this response coming directly at me, where normally I have actors between myself and the audience. And now I know why, because I actually don't want that much attention and focus. You know, it was great to have it deflected through some, you know, brilliant people like Michael Fox especially.
Is that why you hid behind a giant beard for so many years?
Perhaps. And also, you know, I had put on a lot of weight at that time, and there may have been some elements of that. You know, it's hard to say. Yeah, maybe so. And even that middle name that I use, which is just this complete affectation, you know, it's just, I don't know what that was about, and then I got stuck with it, you know.
People don't call you Gary David
Goldberg. No, in fact, my assistant would always know if somebody would call and say, I'm a very good friend of Gary David, she would know that I never met him, you know, because actually, no. You know, it was just like I had screwed up for all those years in my 20s. I think when I resurfaced, I wanted people to know from the old neighborhood that that was me. You know, but no, that's a complete affectation that I'm stuck with now, and nothing I can do.
And it sounds like the name that your mother would yell at you when you're hearing that.
No, no one ever used it. My mother, you know, never used it. It was just completely, I had forgotten I had a middle name, you know.
So let's talk a little bit about how you got into television. You met my pal Matt's dad, Nate Monister, and he had written a bunch of television shows and movies, including That Touch of Mink with Cary Grant, right, and Doris Day. And so you met him, and he encouraged you to write, and what happened?
And then, you know, Nate was just one of those angels, you know, where you just have an angel waiting for you. And when I did decide to come up and give it a try, we were blessed in that we had no money, you know, so we had no distractions. Diana was, had a teaching assistantship, my wife, getting her PhD at that time, and that was all the money we had, which was about $380 a month, and I would sit and work every day, and I just liked writing. I was lucky in that there were great shows on then. Shows like Barney Miller, Mary Tyler Moore, All in the Family, MASH, Newhart. You know, these were terrific shows, so you would write what they call spec scripts, which is your version of that show, and send it off. And in those days, you know, 35 years ago, people were still, you know, available to somebody kind of getting in that way, and people would read the material. And I could tell that I could hear it, you know, what you were saying before, I could hear it, and I could just hear it and feel myself getting better, and I just kept writing and writing and writing and eventually sold something.
What was the first script that you sold?
The first script that I sold was for a show that was called The Dumplings, which briefly came on and off television with James Coco, Geraldine Brooks. What I had done was written an original spec pilot called Free Clinic about time I had spent in Berkeley, you know, kind of volunteering at the Free Clinic. And that impressed them enough to bring me in to talk about The Dumplings, and I had some ideas for that show. I wrote that, and they liked it. Three guys, Nickel, Ross, and West, who then went on to create Three's Company. Mm. And very sweet men, very sweet.
And well, you had a lot of good luck, I guess, but then you got, and a lot of talent. And then you got in kind of in the Mary Tyler Moore production.
Yeah, well, that was the goodest luck of all. Yeah. And I did have a lot of good luck, and just enormous amount of kindness shown to me, almost just from the day I got to Hollywood. I think one thing that worked in my favor is that I was older when I started. I was 31, had never even filed an income tax. I mean, I'd never made enough money. And I could sense that this was an opportunity, and I wasn't going to be outworked, you know. So if I wasn't going to make it, I wasn't going to make it, but it wasn't because I was, you know, lazy or doing something else. So when I showed up, I was ready to go. So I think that was part of it. But these guys were great, and they had a much different idea of comedy than I did. And when we separated, they had sent my stuff over to MTM. And two people there, Gordon and Lynn Farr, and then Tom Patchett and Jay Tarsis, doing Newhart, they liked the material, and that's where my career actually really started. Those were the guys, and Lynn, who really let me in the candy store.
The Chopped Liver Brothers.
Yeah, very talented guys.
We're talking with Gary David Goldberg. We'll just call him Gary Goldberg.
Thank you.
And he's written a book, and it's called Sit, Ubu, Sit, and he was, of course, the comedy writer and producer of Family Ties and Brooklyn Bridge and other wonderful things. So then you were writing for the Newhart Show? Was that where you...
Right, I started with Newhart, and just the way it kind of snowballed, things were happening so quickly that, you know, every day I would come home like with a new job offer, you know, and Diana and I would take a walk around the block with baby Shauna, you know, and we would talk about, well, you know, is this what we want? Those were the days of, are we still the people we set out to be? You know, we're still trying to hold on to our Berkeley roots, which were very quickly evaporating. And, you know, there was just this energy all of a sudden. Because I was at MTM, it was like playing for the Yankees, you know. So everybody, people really didn't know if I was good or not, hadn't even read my stuff, but they knew that MTM liked me, so now they were trying to get me, they were going to try and get me, you know.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Jim Brooks thought I was good, and that was kind of, whoa, Jim Brooks thinks this guy's good. We better get him now, you know. And so it was a lot of that, rather than people reading my material and actually liking it. It was like, well, if Jim Brooks likes him and Patchett and Tarsus like him, then we should like him, you know?
Well, I'm curious then, because you don't talk much in your book about Lou Grant, but Lou Grant was a drama program that you produced.
Right. I don't talk about Lou Grant because I almost don't have a right to, you know? That was not my show. I didn't create it, and it was almost like a gift that they gave me to be on the show. It was almost like a fellowship, you know? Because mm-hmm. that was really Gene Reynolds and Seth Freeman and Alan Burns and Jim Brooks and Michelle Gallery, and MTM, you know, Grant was trying to find a place for me, and I like drama, I love that show, and they kind of graciously made room for me, and I had two wonderful years on that show, maybe three, but I really was not in any way the driving creative force behind that show.
It's a very interesting show. It was probably the only sequel, or a spinoff, I should say, in history, that to spin off from a comedy and become a drama.
Well, it's really a testament to all the talent that put that together, you know, Jim and Alan and Gene, I guess, in particular, who really created that pilot, and Ed, who had the chops to be able to move back and forth in both those worlds, you know. But again, Grant Tinker gets enormous credit because in the same year, even when I was there, the same year, we were the lowest rated show and the number one show in the same year. So it really took the country a little bit of time to come on board. But there was a moment where CBS was trying to really make the show more stupid, you know, in the way that all networks, whenever there's any, not an instant hit, they try whatever is really stupid, it seems. And Grant had said to them, look, we're not going to do a stupid show. This show will work or it won't work on its merits, but it's not going to be a stupid show. And so Grant really held the line there, and ultimately the audience came around.
Well, so that must have been an inspiration in terms of what you did with your shows.
Yeah, I was really fortunate in that I was able to study Grant, study Jim and Alan and Gene, Tom and Jay, you know, really learn from, you know, Ed Weinberger. I mean, really learn from really gifted, professional, grown-up writers and producers. And that was a blessing for me. And I could take whatever little changes I wanted to make in how I was going to work, but the template for how to behave and what it took to do a good show, I learned that all there from those people.
And then I guess we'll just jump to Family Ties. I guess it wasn't the next day, but Family Ties comes along. And what a great show it was. And I think Family Ties represents a kind of a last gasp, really, of a day when network television dominated the world, kind of before VCRs, when people actually watched TV when shows were on.
Yeah, there were several elements involved there that really can't happen anymore in terms of letting a show develop. One, there were only three networks, and there was no Fox yet, you know, which was kind of the end of the world in the sense that so driven by demographics, a specific demographic hit that younger audience, and so driven by just being as outrageous as you can be. And it's like Gresham's law of money, you know, bad money pushes out the good money. It's like Fox kind of pushed out a certain kind of television, and everybody just kind of went along to try to be as low as you could be, you know. The other was there wasn't even at this point an ability to monitor ratings as quickly. So in the beginning, you would just get three overnights, New York, L.A., and Chicago. And then 2 days later, or sometimes even 3 days later, you'd get the rest of the country would come in, and there'd be big variations in that. So in a sense, you could be a failure and not know it yet, you know, because the numbers weren't so instant. the fact that there were no VCRs, very little of that, and the fact that households still maybe had one television set or maybe two at the most, but there weren't like, you know, now you see, you know, 18 sets, so everybody's off watching whatever they're watching. No computers, no video games, so there was still this kind of national campfire available in network television, and in that sense, Family Ties was the perfect show for that model.
And those Thursday nights, those are pretty golden when we had Cosby and Family Ties and
Night Court.
And
it was kind
Hell
of an
Street,
extraordinary
please.
Night for all of us, you know. And then you'd come in Friday morning and you'd see these numbers that were, you know, for now you'd have to have the Super Bowl or the Academy Awards even to come near it, and sometimes it wouldn't even touch the numbers that we were kind of routinely getting, you know. So that was really exciting, and you had this relationship with the audience that was just thrilling, and it only led to more success. You know, we knew our audience was out there. We had great respect for them. We never wanted to insult them or write down to them. And the more that we kind of challenged them, the more they enjoyed it, you know. So it was just a great circle of creative synergy.
At one point in your book, Michael J. Fox says that... he uses his middle initial too. That you should have done another season.
Right. Well, what happened was, you know, at the end of 7 years, you know, Mike, God bless him, you know, he lived up to every scintilla of his contract. You know, he never missed a day of work holding out for more money, never asked to have his parking spot moved or his dressing room enlarged or even his billing changed. I mean, Mike is third billed on that show forever and ever, you know. So he had lived up to every element of that, and now his contract was up, and I, for one, didn't want to see him ever come to work thinking, well, I should be somewhere else, you know, or I didn't want to go to work myself thinking, well, maybe haven't we done this already? So it seemed like it was time to be over. And again, you know, we had so much respect for the audience, for the characters that we had created and lived with, and respect for each other that I didn't ever want to be looking on a stage for Michael Fox across from Michael and thinking, okay, I'm looking at a guy who doesn't want to be here. He's looking at a guy who isn't giving it his all, you know. So we never had that. Our dynamic was always the opposite. And so when we began to feel that it was slipping a little bit, we thought we should go. But, you know, obviously we were still very successful, so people were throwing money at us and trying to come up with ideas. You know, what if we did two shows a week, no audience, and you could get the whole thing done in 13 weeks, you know, and just a really like a rainbow pot full of money. But we said no. And then about 15 years later, I was sitting with Mike at lunch, and without any preamble, he goes, we should have done the eighth year, huh? I go, yeah. Looking back on it, you don't get those opportunities a lot. We should have just done the eighth year.
There was something about Family Ties that I want to touch on, in that the show was it was a comedy show, and there were a lot of laughs in the show, but the laughs never came at the expense of character. The character kind of came first, and there were many moments, and not the kind of maudlin moments that you associate with some kind of very special episodes, but there were some touching and tear-jerking moments occasionally, although you always came back with a big laugh. You always ended the show with a laugh.
I always thought that was our obligation to the audience, that basically, you know, we would say TV Guide, Family Ties, comedy, you know, so I felt if we couldn't deliver on that, ultimately we had no right to do that other show. So we always wanted to get, again, very legitimate laughs. So when Family Ties came on, I had the idea, which was radical at the time, which is, you know, okay, we don't need 10 jokes on the page. I want two jokes that can't be on any other show. You know, and that, so it took, I believe the audience would watch. They would watch intelligent dialogue with really good actors in real situations and wait for that one special joke, and then you get that huge laugh with all the emotion that was being held in. So thank you for noticing. That was the goal, you know, which was to get into those real situations and find the comedy, but never sacrifice that reality.
We're talking with Gary David Goldberg, author of Sit, Ubu, Sit. Now, let me ask you, when you're dealing with that kind of a thing, where you have you get everybody kind of choked up and they're teary, and then you deliver a big laugh, do you think you get a bigger laugh if you've softened them up with making them cry?
I do. I think you get a big laugh, and they're very close together, those two emotions, you know. you always hear, I laughed till I cried, or whatever. You know, they're, because they're both a complete release. You know, what I love about comedy, it's a defeat. You give up. You can't hold on anymore. You know, you've lost. And it's just let it go. It's just a complete let go. And, like what crying is, you can't control it, you know. And so, I do think when you're holding in, and then boom, when it goes, you get those big laughs, which we used to call also laughs of recognition, which are deep laughs, you know, and an audience is seeing something in themselves in that laugh, you know. The easiest thing to do is actually make the audience laugh. It's just, what's the quality of the laugh? And, you know, when you're doing a show, you have to get asked back. And so you need to get, I believe you need a certain kind of quality of laugh to get an audience to want to really pay attention to what you're doing.
Have you stayed, I know that you and Michael J. Fox had some falling out, but are friends again, but have you stayed in contact with the other members of the cast of Family Ties?
We all got together in a thrilling reunion, which was on the Today Show when the book first came out. And I just was so thrilled that everybody was so willing to come to New York and help promote the book. And we had this reunion that was just breathtaking, you know, to see, you know, Tina Yother showing pictures of her kids to Justine Bateman, showing pictures of her kids to Mike Fox, showing pictures of his kids. I mean, it was just an extraordinary moment for me to witness. Meredith has been a family friend, and you see her on holidays, and see Justine a lot. I had lost contact with Michael Gross and Tina, just the way those things kind of sometimes fall away, but you know, but it was really great to everybody be back together again like that.
In a way, it just feels like you know, yesterday that show was on. Because it was on yesterday, as a matter of fact.
It's on a lot now, I'm happy to say, still.
Spin City and Family Ties are both available and around, and they're still on TV a lot, and they're on DVD. But your other show, Brooklyn Bridge, where is it? When will we see it again?
Yeah, you know as much about it as I do. Paramount Television owns the rights to it. When I go around talking, that's the first or second or third question.
Why isn't Brooklyn Bridge on DVD?
And I can't answer that. I don't control the rights. And I guess Paramount's been sold two or three or four times maybe since we did that. And whatever, this current administration just doesn't seem to have any interest in releasing it. I call them, my lawyer calls them once a month, you know. And
You'd like to see it out there.
Oh, yeah, I would love to see it out there.
Yeah. And what was the experience like making that program?
It was very special. It was unique. I don't think I'll ever have that again. You know, I was really lucky with CBS, with Jeff Sagansky, that they really let me do the show. You know, ultimately, I didn't love the way they distributed it and where they placed it and all that. But in terms of creatively getting to do the show that was in my head, that's it exactly. And I don't think a lot of people get to say that. So I choose to look at it. We did 35 shows, and rather than say, I wish I had done 135 shows, I like to look at it and go, wow, I was really lucky to do 35. We tried to do a 23-minute movie each week, and I said to everyone on the show, you know, never come to me and say we can't do this because we're a TV show. We're not. We're a 23-minute movie, and it was exciting. It was just exciting. And then to see, of course, a lot of it was so autobiographical that some of it was really jarring. And Amy Aquino, who played my mother on the show, she kept saying, I need better dialogue. You're trying to get even with your mother here, you know? So there may have been something in that.
Was she right? Yeah.
Well, it was hard. I never, even in real life, often didn't know where my mother was coming from, you know? So it was harder to write her for me sometimes.
Did the network ever say this show is too Jewish? We don't want to...
No, never. Not even remotely an issue. When we went into business, Jeff and I knew this was the show we were doing, and they never backtracked from that one bit.
And you made a feature film a few years ago, The Delightful Must Love Dogs, which with John Cusack and Diane Lane, a wonderful picture.
Thank you.
And are you done now? You're not going to make any more?
Yeah, I think I am. My mechanism that's harder for me. You know, my mechanism isn't naturally in the movie business. You know, it's just a different... just a different animal. You know, really what I loved was the Monday through Friday, we do the show Friday night in front of a live audience, you get all that interaction with the actors, all that time to change it, to make it better, get all that input, and then get the energy from the live audience. here, when you're doing a comedy, like a movie, you're shooting out of sequence. You know, John Cusack in that movie, who I adore him, you know, he was so much fun, and Diane, it was just great to work with both of them. But John, he, on his first night, because of the way the board laid out, he was shooting his next to last scene in the movie. That was the culmination of all he had been through with Diane Lane's character. And that was literally the first scene he shot. You know, so you need to be John Cusack.
And to be able to do that, yeah.
Yeah, to be able to do that. And so you don't even know what you're holding in your head the whole time. You know, with a Family Ties episode, I could hold the whole thing in my head all the time. All the shots, all the dialogue, everything. I just could always carry it around with me, the whole picture of it. Mm-hmm. In the movie, you're just trying to live through another day, you know, and get to the editing room.
Yeah. Now, when you were doing Family Ties and you had it all in your head, is on after the show was shot, did you just jettison it immediately and start putting together the next one?
I'm still rewriting some of those Family Ties episodes.
Really?
When I see them on DVD now and I go, why were we in that shot? We should have been in another angle. I mean, that couldn't have been the best shot we had. But you had to, in terms of the process of making the show each week, let it go. But the one thing I insisted on, when we would start up again Monday morning and you're back at square one, I would love to take the first hour and just talk about how good we are, what we accomplished, how much we all love each other, and okay, now let's go back in there and try to go back and fix this next one. But it's an incredible relentless pace at network television. At some point, you wish you could have supered, you know, put a little crawl under the scene going, entire writing cast sick this week. You know, we apologize. We all had the flu. This was the best we could do, you know, because you can't stop it. It's a machine.
Yeah. Well, your book, and it's really a marvelous book, and it's called Sit, Ubu, Sit. And you wrote it in a very non-linear way, and I recommend it to all of our listeners. It was a wonderful read. And it was you wrote it in a present tense narrative, and I wonder if you have a novel in you. Maybe that will be the next thing that you do.
Well, I'm toying with that, and maybe a play, you know. But I think I'm done with the other world. It I don't think anyone ever had as much fun as I had in show business, in what I called, you know, filmed entertainment, television, movies. But I think the world has changed. I think it's just not as wonderful as it once was, perhaps. And I really liked writing the book. It was really a great way for me to work and completely control my life, you know, which really revolves around my wife and my dogs now. So that way I get up in the morning, I like to get up early, I write for 3 hours, 4 hours, and then I can, you know, fold that up and just get down to walking the dogs.
Speaking of dogs, the name of the book is Sit, Ubu, Sit, and the writer and creator of Family Ties and Spin City and Brooklyn Bridge and Must Love Dogs, Gary David Goldberg. Thank you so much for spending some time with us tonight.
It was really my pleasure, Gary. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf, but I'll be back next week with another great program. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her help. Thanks, Breanne. For KUSP, I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening, everybody.